You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
When Barack Obama introduced himself to the American public at the 2004 Democratic Convention, he described the promise of America as including the hope of a skinny kid with a funny name who believes that America has a place for him, too. In his new book, New Yorker editor David Remnick explores how Mr. Obama developed his sense of self and how it has steered his unlikely path to the White House. The Bridge, The Life and Rise of Barack Obama is published by Knopf, and I'm very pleased that it brings Mr. Remnick back to our show today. Welcome back.
It's great to be here in these beautiful studios.
Yeah, isn't it amazing?
Oh, my God. It's fabulous.
It's a pleasure to come to work for a change. Barack Obama wrote a lot about the formation of his identity in his own books. Why did you want to explore it here?
And why so quickly, I guess, and to extend the question in a way, I wanted to understand him. I was extremely fascinated by and surprised, and quite frankly surprised by. I had a bet with the executive editor at The New Yorker, Dorothy Wickenden, when he started to make noise about running. And I said, come on, Barack Hussein Obama, in this country at this time, not only is he African-American, he's named as, little did I know, this drama of his name and all these questions had come up every step of his political path. I lost good money to her on that bet.
Well, people asked me the same thing after he was on the show to talk about his memoir. They said, well, did you see a potential president there? And I said, wait, Barack Hussein Obama, and he's black. But I thought I was very impressed by him.
He's nothing if not impressive. And you go back, if you go back on YouTube, for example, Connie Martinson, who runs this book talk show on what used to be called Public Access TV in L.A., out of her house, interviewed Obama in 1995, I think it was. And at one point, she very sweetly, if a little bit patronizingly, turns to him, and he's a very young guy. He's even skinnier, even younger, and his kind of suit looks like he doesn't, you know, it looked extremely modest, and it's in her living room. And she says, you know, have you ever thought about getting into politics one day? And Obama, very sweetly, as if it's the first time anybody had ever mentioned it, said, you know, well, I'll think about it.
As a teenager, he felt he had to teach himself to be black. How do you do that?
Well, far be it from me to know precisely. I'm not. But have you ever been to Hawaii? I mean, it really is.
I have been to Hawaii.
It is the weirdest feeling. It's 5 hours west of by plane from L.A., and you really feel you're in the middle of the ocean. And here he is in Honolulu, in the most elite school, I should say. I mean, it looks like, you know, Exeter on the sea. And there are no, and it's a place that prides itself in multicultural everything, even before there was such a word. But there are almost no black people. The only black people around are on military bases. And he's got these white grandparents at home and a completely absent mythological father and a mother who's in and out of Indonesia and a couple of classmates who are black. So it's very, very difficult for him to do the way, how do I learn to be a Jewish American? At the kitchen table, in school, and with friends. So he does it through television, through reading. He really can't do it any other way.
And listening to people like Marvin Gaye, Stevie Wonder, Grover Washington.
Or reading, and as he gets older, reading Richard Wright or Malcolm X and the great memoir tradition of African-American literature.
Well, I was thinking about Grover Washington. I'm not sure he's a good teacher, but then again, Bill Clinton loved Kenny G. So, but were you surprised by the writers that made the biggest impression on him?
No. I think he was a kind of underachiever as a high school student. He was reading above his achievement level. He was a B student. It was a good school, but he was a B student. He was, in addition to reading serious books, he was also playing a lot of basketball, doing just okay in class, drinking a little bit, smoking a little weed. It's things that are not exactly unique to an American teenager. I mean, it's not that big a deal. But he doesn't really become super ambitious and in the throw of the American super meritocrats until he gets to Harvard Law School, which is quite a ways down the road.
But then he's reading Malcolm X, for example, although he is fascinated with certain aspects of it, not with the strident parts. He's reading Richard Wright, Ralph Ellison,
Toni Morrison,
James Baldwin. Perhaps part of the interest was that he also flirted with the idea of becoming a novelist.
It's absolutely true. By the time he is at Columbia University, he's a transfer student in his third and fourth year. He's writing, he's keeping a diary. He's writing short stories. Certainly by the time he gets to Chicago as a community organizer in his early 20s, he's writing very consistently in the early mornings and over the weekends. And when I talked to his sister in Hawaii, Maya, I said, what would have become of your brother had he not become a full-time politician? Because that that almost happened. I mean, he lost a congressional race in 2000. He may well have become a kind of combination writer, civil liberties lawyer, teacher at the University of Chicago, that kind of life where he's both doing well and doing good. His personality is closer to a writer's personality than any major politician I've ever met. Bill Clinton has written a memoir, but that is not a writer's personality.
What did you think of Barack Obama as a stylist?
You know, I think if we look at that book, and we're talking about the first book. The first book is a real book. The second book is good, but it's a kind of campaign book. The first book is a highly literary, highly structured, writerly book, sometimes maybe a little purple at times. It's a young man's book.
He always ends up every chapter crying.
Both all three sections ends up with him in tears and moments of revelation. He finds his faith. He finds a reconciliation with his dead father. I don't mean to mock it, but there's a programmatic side to it. But there are also moments in it that are brilliant, and it's a real book. In other words, it doesn't feel like a product. If you look at Mitt Romney's new book, it's a product. It's there for a political purpose.
You reprint some of the letters that he wrote to friends, and I'm sure they gave you some insight. Also to his mother, who, as you say, was in Indonesia, and one of the letters from his mother says that he better get his grades up before he applies to college. But where did you get these letters? Have they been published before?
Well, the letters I've got that you're talking about, there's particularly some letters from a guy who now lives in California named Phil Berner, who was Obama's roommate and friend at Occidental College in California and then transferred at the same time with him to Columbia. And there's one letter in particular that I print in full over the course of a couple of pages. Obama first gets to Chicago and is settling in as a community organizer. And it's a beautiful letter. It's his first impressions of Chicago, how he sees the South Side, the gaps between rich and poor and black and white. It's him seeing this big, very interesting city, contrasting it with New York and other places. It's very vivid. I got some letters thanks to Alice Dewey, the granddaughter of John Dewey, who was the academic mentor of Obama's mother. And she writes some very vivid letters, especially from Indonesia, that give a picture of her life there. She's the character, I think, that is really underportrayed in Obama's own book. In other words, Obama's writing a book that where his father is an enormous, almost ghostly figure, almost metaphorical figure in his own memoir. In my book, in this biography, the mother, who had seemed almost flighty in a kind of batik skirt, you know, 60s, aging 60s, not serious person, actually is an extremely serious person, a fascinating figure.
Stanley Ann is her name, although everybody called her Ann. He also did write to his father in Kenya for many years. What led him to stop?
I think he just got tired of the non-relationship there. I mean, his father's in Kenya, and not exactly the best father in the world, and a pretty terrible husband to Stanley Ann and a succession of wives.
My guest is David Remnick. His latest book, The Bridge, The Life and Rise of Barack Obama. Where did Barack Obama developed the caution that so many people have commented on? Was it there from the beginning?
Well, I wonder about this business of caution as opposed to his capacity for conciliation or the urge for it. He's a president that wants to make a big impact. He may not do it with the boldest or most kind of ferocious rhetoric of a Truman or some of his predecessors. But, you know, 14 months out, he passed, unlike many presidents who have tried before,
from Harry Truman on,
a very bold domestic policy initiative. It may not be as bold as you and I would like, but I'm not sure that's the Obama administration's fault. His manner of presentation may be somewhat professorial, cool and diffident to some people, but I think there's a great ambition there as a president.
But in the light of his rather measured style, are you surprised by some of the claims of the fringe groups that he's a radical? I get emails every day.
I think some of your previous guests were talking about this, and they're absolutely right that a lot of this is the result of a propaganda that has enormous currency on cable television, call it for what it is, Fox, and on the internet. And I still get emails about the birth certificate stuff and where he was born and socialist, communist, Nazi, all at once. I mean, this is a terrible distorting mirror in our political culture. And I believe ferociously in a multi-sided debate, whether it's about politicians or about any issue. This is not that. This is something ugly and really terrible in our political culture. It's not unprecedented, but the means of communication have changed.
Well, was it Maureen Dowd wrote an article suggesting that race was really the reason behind so much of this anger? A lot of people got upset. But your book is a lot about race because it's impossible to get around it when you deal with Barack Obama.
What is the rhetoric of the extreme end of the Tea Party movement? And I'm not saying that there aren't real working class people with real economic anxieties that are being expressed. But some of the rhetoric, the ugly rhetoric, is what is the code word here for race? It's we want our country back. We want our country back. What does that mean? It means that there's a combustion, as your previous guests were suggesting, of economic uncertainty married to the spectacle and the reality of the first African-American president. And for some people, unfortunately, that is very scary. And to have the first African-American president is a big change. Look, this is a country centuries old, and we've had nothing but white Anglo-Saxon Protestants and one Catholic.
So how did he, because race is an issue even among people who deny that race is an issue, how did he become president of the Harvard Law Review?
I think part of it is the talent for conciliation. First of all, he was a star. He had a very big backer academically in Larry Tribe, who was one of the leading constitutional scholars in the country, if not the leading.
But not likely to be named to the Supreme Court?
No. I think at this point he's too old. Mm-hmm. You don't want to be nominating people in there after a certain age, and he is that. He also had a kind of personal talent that you see in politics. He had not only liberals and African Americans supporting him, and whites, but he also gave the impression to the conservatives on the Law Review that he was listening to them. He may not agree with them, but he was listening to them. And not everybody who was running, and half the review seemed to run for it, gave that impression.
You mentioned throughout the book that he can get bored easily. Has that, how has that driven his career decisions throughout his life?
He was bored in the state Senate in Springfield, not without reason. He gets to the U.S. Senate. Imagine this, the U.S. Senate, and he finds it, lo and behold, bewilderingly bureaucratic and caught up in a kind of rhetorical flourishes that didn't interest him. And one of his aides told me he only really came alive at night when he was writing his book. Let's just hope that the presidency isn't boring him. I don't think it is.
My guest is David Remnick, who is it editor-in-chief?
We just call it editor.
Editor of The New Yorker. He's been writing about Barack Obama on and off in the Talk of the Town articles and in other articles over the years. And now there is this very large book, over 600 pages, about somebody we thought we knew a lot about. But I guess the big surprise for so many reviewers has been, gee, you're giving us a Barack Obama that we kind of knew, but we suspected.
Well, there was a lot of good journalism about him in The New Yorker, The New York Times, Chicago Tribune, and elsewhere, and NPR, and for a long campaign. That was a very dramatic campaign. But the job of that journalism is very different from from this. And of course, you know, 20 years from now, some Robert Caro will come along and spend years and years in archives and oral histories and do something else and even more expensive. I wanted to understand somebody while he was still in office for another 3 years and maybe even seven.
The book, The Bridge, The Life and Rise of Barack Obama, published by Knopf. We will continue our conversation after this. My guest is David Remnick of The New Yorker. His latest book is called The Bridge, The Life and Rise of Barack Obama. It's published by Knopf. Why do you describe Obama's ability to appeal to the audience in front of him as being multilingual?
Well, I think many politicians and many great orators have the capacity to shift their frame of reference, their rhetoric, their pitch, depending on who they're in the room with. Martin Luther King Jr., the greatest American orator and maybe the greatest prophetic voice the country has ever known.
At least since Abraham Lincoln.
Certainly.
And we don't have recordings of his speeches.
Alas. And Martin Luther King was capable, for one audience, of quoting Reinhold Niebuhr and Barth and all the great tradition of European theologians, and then go to the next room and be as, you know, foot-stomping as in any black church. He was able to do that and still remain himself and not be a phony. Obama has this to a junior degree.
Comes from a very different kind of background.
Exactly.
Martin Luther King came out of the black church. His father was a famous minister. Barack Obama, as you point out, grew up almost as a white kid who had to teach himself to be black.
Well, some friends of mine, African-Americans who come from a church tradition, who admire Obama on one level, also find they think he doesn't have an absolutely perfect ear for this. And when they hear him do the intonation of a black church, they cringe a little bit. This seems to me a pretty high level of discernment. But clearly, somebody learned something here. Obama didn't have this skill when he started out as a politician. When he ran for Congress in 2000, that's not so long ago, and we got his backside handed to him by Bobby Rush, he was kind of imperious on the stump, professorial. People saw him as standoffish and an outsider, but he went into hundreds and hundreds of these churches, and he had also heard it as an organizer, so he started to get this and make it his own. He could not come off sounding like Martin Luther King. He would sound ridiculous.
But these are lessons that certain kinds of politicians have to learn. Cory Booker had to learn it in Newark for the same reason, because Sharp James did similar things
to
him
that
Bobby Rush did to him, to Barack Obama.
And of course, Cory Booker is a member of what Obama calls the Joshua generation of African Americans and African American politicians, like Arthur Davis in Alabama, or Harold Ford, who seems to have come up against a political wall, and many others, the mayor of Philadelphia, Michael Nutter.
Mm-hmm. As opposed to the Moses generation?
Of the civil rights generation, of John Lewis, King, Joe Lowry.
What does he say about how he tries to appeal to the audience in front of him?
He knows what he's doing. This is the irony of what the criticism of Harry Reid. He put it very poorly. There's no doubt about it in Game Change. But Harry Reid was right that Jesse Jackson could not go the final distance. His appeal was not going to be that broad. Look at the great political educative moment for Barack Obama. People learn from failure. Obama tried to run against Bobby Rush in 2000. It was an impious move. He tried to upset a traditional 60s, post-60s African-American politician on his own turf, and he couldn't do it. There was no reason to fire Bobby Rush, according to the community. And he learned to be a different kind of politician, Obama did, by traveling around southern Illinois and seeing that he appealed to a much wider audience.
Bobby Rush is highly critical of the way Obama has changed over the years.
Bobby Rush is having a good time. I mean, Bobby Rush gets to be the guy in Washington who beat Barack Obama. And when I interviewed him in his office, it was extraordinary. At one point, he got out of his chair, and he started doing a very sinuous walk across the room. And Bobby Rush is a man of a certain age by now. And he said, you know, Barack, this is Barack Obama's walk now. He wasn't walking like that when he ran against me for Congress.
Isn't it harder to keep the adaptability that Barack Obama has maintained the more visible you become and the more your opponents try to define you?
Well, you get picked apart by ducks, and I'm one of the ducks, I guess. So we're always examining presidents with such eagle eye. You know, can he pitch? Can he shoot a basketball? What does he sound like? You know, can he swat a fly? All this kind of stuff becomes grist for the kind of political entertainment mill.
You start the book describing Barack Obama's speech in Selma, Alabama on March 4th, 2007. Why was that such a pivotal speech in Obama's path to the presidency?
Yeah, it's a speech that comes after he's announced, just after he's announced. Selma, you know, Selma is the place in 1965 of Bloody Sunday and then of the great march from Selma to Montgomery. It's the resonant place that it's celebrated every year, every 2 years.
And it's the bridge the title of your book.
Exactly, the Edmund Pettus Bridge, as well as the metaphor for various reasons. And Obama went there in 2007, as did Hillary, to kick off their campaigns, but to speak directly to the African-American audience. Because, he didn't have that vote in the bag, and the African-American audience, the African-American electorate, is crucial to a Democratic victory in the primaries. Not in Iowa, but certainly beyond there. And that's where he gives his Joshua Generation speech. It's where Joe Lowry gets up and says something crazy may happen in America, and referring to this possibility of Obama winning.
And Joe Lowry becomes one of the first of the older generation to commit himself.
That's right.
Many of the others felt that he was trying to do it too soon, that he needed a little more seasoning.
That's right. I mean, Andy Young certainly was very dismissive of Obama's attempt, and in a particularly nasty way, I got to say, which he apologized for later. And John Lewis, who really liked Obama a lot, finally went with his loyalties, and in the beginning of the campaign was pro-Clinton. He was really torn about it, and at a certain point he switched, and he said, I had an executive session with myself, and I felt that I was against the tide of history, and I could no longer do that. And I also, in political terms, he was facing possible opposition in his own congressional district.
My guest is David Remnick. His latest book, The Bridge, The Life and Rise of Barack Obama from Knopf. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Hillary Clinton was criticized quite a bit during the campaign for playing fast and loose with history. But throughout the book, you point out liberties that Obama has taken in his books and in his speeches. Has he ever explained why he's done that? Or is this just what politicians
sometimes
do?
Sometimes poetry comes before strict adherence to the facts. So, for example, in the Joshua Generation speech, he implies, and is pretty direct about it, that somehow the Kennedy family funded an airlift of Kenyan students, and so therefore, you know, he's trying to draw a line between himself and Camelot, in the same way that Bill Clinton had that photograph of himself as a kid shaking hands with Kennedy that he used in all those ads. Well, it's kind of true. The Kennedys did fund the Kenyan airlift of students, but they did it a year after Obama's father went on the airlift, so it really wasn't quite the case. He was stretching a point to make a poem.
Do you think this is the reason he was comfortable choosing Joe Biden, who has been caught plagiarizing other politicians' speeches?
I think the Biden plagiarizing thing was long, long in the past. The concern about Biden had to do with the concern that we see now, which is that he's, well, you know, you saw it when he was signing the health care bill, and Biden gave a great big stage whisper about what a big deal it was in his ear. It's that moment. But I think the reason Biden was brought in as vice president is the experience question, and also the attachment to working-class voters, which Biden seems to have an image of.
Why was going to Chicago and launching his political career a stroke of good luck for Obama? He could have gone to any of a number of cities.
I think he might have gotten lost more easily in New York or Los Angeles. Chicago, although it's certainly a big town.
But people might have related better to him in New York because of his style. Chicago has this long history of black politics.
But he didn't go right into
politics. Of the Bobby Rush sort.
He didn't go right into politics. He went into community organizing, and he went into this very distinctly black side of town, the Chicago South Side. He lived in Hyde Park which is much more mixed, the Hyde Park, Kenwood area. He lives in Kenwood, strictly speaking, now, when he's not in the White House. This gave him a sense of real mission and community, which anybody needs, certainly somebody in public life.
And you say that one of his key mentors came when he was a community organizer.
A guy named Jerry Kelman, a white guy, a guy who placed an ad for a community organizer in a little newspaper called Community Jobs. And Jerry Kelman is a really interesting, devoted organizer, lifetime organizer, a Jewish guy from New Rochelle who converted to Catholicism, deeply involved with Catholic charities on the South Side. And he got to know Obama in a way no journalist now can do it. He, you know, day after day, hours and hours together in McDonald's or wherever they were spent, long walks together along along Lake Michigan. So he was a really important witness for me.
In his work as a community organizer in Chicago, Obama worked with a lot of different preachers, and I'm sure that he learned from that as well. But what was it about Reverend Jeremiah Wright and Trinity United Church of Christ that intrigued him? You would think if he rejected Malcolm X's stridency, he would have rejected Timothy Wright's stridency. Timothy Wright was a gospel singer. Wright's stridency.
One of the great gospel singers. Jeremiah Wright, it's obvious what his drawbacks are, what his faults are, what his at times prejudices are and his hurts are. But it's maybe not so obvious to people now what his great virtues were. Not only had he built a church from almost no congregants to thousands on the South Side, he had also shown a devotion to humanity, to AIDS, people with AIDS, HIV/AIDS, to people who needed help with addiction, or the people who were just out of prison. This is not a universal. There are a lot of ministers, black and white, who were extremely conservative about these issues. Obama was drawn to that. I think Obama was drawn to what he saw as the authenticity of it.
But didn't he hear those inflammatory remarks that were so destructive, actually hurt him during his campaign? I think that was one of his major vulnerabilities during the campaign.
You know, I know for a fact that a lot of us have sat in the pews or in congregations and synagogues and churches without being namby-pamby about this and have heard priests and rabbis and imams say things that we find even distasteful, much less things we don't agree with, and we still go for other reasons. And Obama's claim, and there's no reason, no evidence to disprove him, is that the most inflammatory things, not that he never heard a radical notion from Jeremiah Wright, but those particulars that got on ABC and on the air were things that he was not there for, and he had long since stopped going to church regularly for political reasons and geographical reasons.
But actually, it turned out to work in his behalf, because if the firestorm surrounding Reverend Wright hadn't happened, he probably wouldn't have given that major speech on race, which turned a lot of people around.
I'm not sure it turned a lot of people around. It certainly rescued him from disaster. I think if he had not made that speech, if that whole issue, the notion of radicalism and anger, and let's face it, a racially charged set of emotions for a lot of people who are not inclined to be sympathetic, could have ended his campaign.
When he was deciding whether to run for president, Barack Obama told a fundraiser, "The white folks want me to run, and the black folks think I'm going to get killed."
Yeah, it's absolutely true. He shoved aside that notion of security once he had been satisfied that he would get the security that he needed. He's not naive. He knows what country he lives in, and he knows our history.
Well, he had the Jeremiah Wright problem, and then he didn't appear on the campaign trail with Jesse Jackson Jr., with Al Sharpton. Tavis Smiley, Cornel West, both were critical of him.
The African-American community is diverse, and why shouldn't it be? It's diverse in its political opinions and all the rest. I think Cornel West and Tavis Smiley certainly supported Obama, but from the left, and they criticize him from the left. Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton during a campaign might not have done him good. In fact, the Obama campaign not so subtly asked Al Sharpton to stay home in places like Iowa. But now Al Sharpton is actually quite useful to the Obama administration, isn't he?
In July 2008, your magazine, The New Yorker, ran a cover drawn by Barry Blitt that depicted the Obamas in the Oval Office with Barack Obama wearing a turban and a robe and Michelle Obama with an afro and a machine gun pumping fists while the American flag burns in the fireplace. It was obviously a satire, but on the other hand, many people were really upset. Were you surprised by just...
I was surprised by the scale
how much of
it, the intensity of it. And I have to say, the vast, vast majority of the letters and emails and phone calls that I got said the following thing. Of course I understand it. I get it. It's those people out there who are not going to understand it or get it, and they're going to use it as a terrible instrument to whip up hatred. I have to say, whether you agree with me or disagree with me on the cover, and I respect both, that reaction did not happen. People that are inclined to be horrendous racists and to believe nonsense that were and have been manipulated by Sean Hannity or whoever it happens to be on the internet did not need a piece of satire on the cover of The New Yorker, and that no matter what you thought of it. And I should tell you another New Yorker story. Not long ago, before the healthcare triumph and Obama was having a very hard time, that same artist, Barry Blitt, did a terrific four-paneled cover. And in the first three panels, you see Obama walking across the water with the obvious biblical reference. And in the fourth panel, he falls in. The cover came out on a Monday. By Monday afternoon, I got a phone call from Eric Lesser, who's the assistant to David Axelrod, saying, the president and David were just in here laughing hysterically about that cover. Can we get a signed copy? And so Barry wrote the following, Dear Mr. President, please stay dry. Yours, Barry Blitt. Now, I don't know whether Obama really thought it was funny or he wanted to advertise the notion that that he thought it was funny, but there it was.
We're pretty much out of time, but a listener, Joseph from Brooklyn, would like you to comment on the degree to which George Bush's presidency acted as a catalyst for someone completely outside the mold to fill the seat.
I think that's a great question. And it certainly made it impossible, near impossible, for a Republican to think that he could waltz in. That it was made it very difficult for McCain or Romney or anybody else, number one. Number two, I think the degree of catastrophe, let's call it by what it was, in the economy and in other issues made people think harder about what was needed. And not to say that Barack Obama is a radical. The most radical thing about Barack Obama is that he's African-American, as Skip Gates is quoted as saying in this book. But I think that it allowed the political imagination to expand.
David Remnick's latest book is The Bridge, The Life and Rise of Barack Obama, published by Knopf. Thank you so much for being with us again.
It's always a pleasure to be here.